Okay, so today we're going to continue studying ontological models, and the main topic we're going to talk about eventually is this thing, psi ontology, or the reality of the wave function. This is quite a fun lecture for me because this is closely related to research that I've done. And whenever I talk about this particular topic, I am supposed to wear this t-shirt. If you want to know why, you can ask me after the lecture. Okay, but before we get to that, we need to do a little bit more on contextuality, partly because the results that we'll present will be relevant for the next part. So, that's not working now. Okay. Just to remind you from last time, what we meant by Cochin-Speck and non-contextuality, right? So Cochin-Speck and non-contextuality applies to models where all the measurements are projective measurements. And then the model is outcome deterministic, which means that every projector in every measurement that includes it either gets a value 0 or 1. And the model has to be measurement non-contextual, so these probabilities are functions of the projectors alone and not which basis, not which measurement they're included in. So equivalently, we can say that each of these lambdas is going to assign every projector a value 0 or 1. Every set of orthogonal projectors that sum to the identity, so every projective measurement, exactly one of those projectors has to get assigned the value 1, and the rest have to get assigned the value 0. That is so that this thing for every lambda will be a probability distribution over the projective measurement. Okay, so it's fashionable these days to try to detect contextuality in the same sort of way as we detect non-locality in Bell's theorem, which is using inequalities. So people like to write down contextuality inequalities, but they're sort of conceptually a little bit more subtle than Bell inequalities, but I want to explain one way of thinking about them. So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about this particular proof of contextuality here. So where does this come from? If you remember at the end of last lecture, I showed you the Perez-Mermin magic square, right? So it consisted of 9 observables in a 3x3 table. Every row consisted of mutually commuting observables. Every column consisted of mutually commuting observables. Now what you can do is you can write down the projectors onto the joint eigenbases of each column and of each row. Because that was in a four-dimensional Hilbert space, 2 qubits, each of those is going to have 4 eigenstates. So each row is going to have 4 mutual eigenstates. Each column is going to have 4 mutual eigenstates. So you're going to get 6 times 4, 24 projectors, 24 one-dimensional projectors, actually. So if you write down all those projectors and you try to assign zeros and ones to them in this way, then obviously you must fail because that's equivalent to assigning values to the observables as we did last time. So then what people did was they realized, okay, I've got this set of 24 projectors. Actually, if I take out a couple of the projectors, I still get a contextuality proof. So people did that for some time until it finally was boiled down to 18 one-dimensional projectors. This is the record for the smallest contextuality proof without inequalities in 4 dimensions. People play these games where they try to get the smallest size proofs. It's like something like 36 in 3 dimensions, 18 in 4 dimensions, etc. It seems like more of a mathematical game than physics, but people like these kinds of things. Okay, so what you end up with is you end up with these 18 states. And what this diagram means is when these things are grouped together in one of these colored things, that means they form an orthonormal basis, right? So this purple group is an orthonormal basis. This blue square of 4 states is an orthonormal basis, etc. Okay, so there's a structure like that that exists in a 4-dimensional Hilbert space. Now, if we're going to have a non-contextual model, we ought to be able to assign a value 1 to exactly one state in each of those orthonormal bases. But if you try to do that, then you find that you always fail. There's always one basis at the end where you can't do it. So let's see an example of that. So we start here, and let's say we decide to assign this one value 1. Okay? So then when we go over to this red basis here, I can't assign this guy value 1 because that would have two that have assigned value 1 in this basis. So it has to be one of these three, so let's pick this one. And then let's go down. Actually, I've missed 2 here. There should be one that I should be able to do this one too. Or maybe there's 2 bases I can't do. Oh no, that's right. It's this one that I can't do. Okay, so let's now go over here to this one. Then you see, okay, well, that I've got one in this black basis, I've got one in this red basis, it has to be this one or this one, so I choose this one. And then I go over here, and I'm like, okay, well, I've got the blue basis filled, so it can't be that one. I've got this one already, so it can't be that one. Can't be that one, it has to be this one. And then that means that this basis is already filled, so now we go over here to this basis here, and then you see, okay, well, over here, the red basis is filled, so it can't be that one. Here, this basis is filled, so it can't be that one. This basis is filled, so it can't be that one. And finally, the green basis is filled, so it can't be that one. So when I get that far, I find that the final basis, I can't assign anything of value 1. So that shows you that there's no non-contextual model. Okay, so however you try, so that was one particular way of doing it. There's a great deal of symmetry here, so it's fairly easy to see that any other way of trying to do it would be equivalent. Right? Each of these vectors is in precisely 2 bases. So however you try to do this, you always end up with one basis that can't be filled. And you see that you only have 4 things that are assigned value 1 as you try to do that. So then people often just try to say, well, what that means is that there's an inequality. If I look at the probability, if I sum over all these states and I look at the probability assigned to them in a non-contextual model, it has to be less than 4 because I've only got 1, 2, 3, 4 filled in. So that's sort of the naive way of saying we can make a non-contextuality inequality. However, that's just totally wrong. So any theory, regardless of whether it's contextual or non-contextual, has to predict some outcome for every measurement, right? When we fill these things in, we've got no prediction for this measurement whatsoever. So what this proof tells you is not that non-contextual states can only assign a value 4 here. It tells you that no non-contextual states exist, right? So it's sort of completely analogous from Bell's theorem. In Bell's theorem, you can consider a local model. Local models exist. They don't agree with the predictions of quantum mechanics, but they exist. And you can say a local model would predict at most 2 for the Bell inequality, for instance. Here you can't say that. You can't say a non-contextual model would predict this. There just isn't a non-contextual model, right? So there's a sort of bit of a conceptual problem, a conceptual gap with understanding what an inequality like this means. So what I want to do is outline one way of making sense of such inequalities. Okay, so let's suppose we have, like we did here, some finite set of orthonormal bases. Okay, those orthonormal bases may overlap, so you may have the same state phi in M1 and in M2, for instance. Okay, so if phi is an outcome of some particular basis, then we can define, as we did before, the set of states that assign value 1 to that outcome in that particular basis. Okay, we've defined that before. But now I'm going to do something slightly different, which is I'm going to define the non-contextual set for phi. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take all of these, so phi can appear in multiple different bases. So for each basis that phi appears in, there's one of these sets. I'm just going to take the intersection of all those sets, right? So in words, this is the set of Wontek states that always assigns this projector probability 1, regardless of the basis it appears in, right? However, however you measure whether the system's in state phi, whichever basis you choose to do it, this set of states always gives value 1. Okay, so I can always construct this set in any theory. It might be empty, right? There may be no non-contextual states for phi, right? But I can construct this set. Okay, so this is, I'm calling this the non-contextual set for phi. It's the set of ontic states that give this outcome non-contextually. Okay, so if your model is Cochin spec and non-contextual, then all states, all ontic states are non-contextual for every outcome, right? So in a Cochin Specker non-contextual model, this general ontic model prediction would reduce to this. I can always restrict attention to integrating only over the non-contextual states for each outcome, because in a non-contextual theory, those are the only states, right? Now, on this set, this indicator function is, this response function, rather, is always equal to 1. That's the definition of, that's part of the definition of this set, okay? So this term is always 1. So this is just the integral of the probability measure over this non-contextual set, and that's what I mean by the probability of being in that non-contextual set given that you prepared psi, okay? So if you're in a KS non-contextual model, then the quantum probability has to equal this, the probability of being in the non-contextual set. Actually, this is an equivalent to the definition of Cochin-Specker non-contextuality up to measure zero issues again, right? Because an equation like this, I could always have, you know, if this equation holds, there could always be some states that are measure zero that are completely contextual, and you'd never detect that from this condition. But you can always remove them, and it's like just some analytic things you have to do. But the important thing is that KS non-contextual model implies this. Okay, so if you have a model that's Cochin Specker contextual, then these two things may not be equal, but because this is a subset of this, you will have a greater than or equal to sign here, right? So in a Cochin-Specker non-contextual model, you have the quantum probability, it's greater than or equal to the probability of being in the non-contextual set, okay? So, but this probability still makes sense. It's measuring the proportion of the probability of obtaining this outcome that is accounted for by ontic states that are non-contextual for phi, right? So in an arbitrary ontological model, I'll have some ontic states that are non-contextual for phi and some that aren't, right? And this is measuring how much of the probability of getting the outcome phi comes from that, okay? Right, so now what we can show is that if you have two states that are orthogonal, then their non-contextual sets are disjoint. Why is that? Okay, well, if you have two states that are orthogonal, then there exists some orthonormal basis that includes them, right? You can always take two orthogonal states and add a bunch of other states and make an orthonormal basis. We know that in that basis, these sets are disjoint. So the things that give probability 1 for that particular measurement, they have to be disjoint because the response functions for that measurement are probabilities. So if I sum, right, so if I sum over all the outcomes in the basis, I need to get 1. So if I sum over just these two outcomes, it's less than or equal to 1. So if this term is 1, this term has to be 0. If this term's 1, this term has to be 0. So these are always disjoint. Always make some mistake, right? So what it should be is that is the other way around. So the non-contextual set is a subset of this for this particular basis. Simply because these non-contextual sets are defined at the intersection of all these guys, right? So if these two are disjoint, then these two are disjoint. Okay, so then if you have an orthonormal basis, then the non-contextual sets are pairwise disjoint. So any ontic state can be in at most one of them. Okay, it doesn't have to be in any of them because it could instead be a state that's contextual for one of these outcomes. Okay. Or it could be in a state that's non-deterministic, that doesn't give that with probability one. But we can separate the ontic state space out into these guys, which are non-contextual for the various outcomes, and the rest. Okay, so now we can make sense of this, right? Because of this argument, right, if you try to assign non-contextually values, then you always fail to get the last basis. Then if you take this sum, you will always get less than or equal to 4. Okay, for any ontic state. It can only be in at most 4 of these 4 of these non-contextual sets. So then if I just take this and I average over some probability measure corresponding to some state that I prepared, then that will still be true. I'm just averaging this over a probability distribution. So therefore, you can say that in general, this inequality holds. It holds in any ontological model, right? So we don't have to, there doesn't have to exist a non-contextual one, which there doesn't exist any non-contextual one, but this inequality holds in any ontological model, and it measures how much of the probability can be accounted for by states that are non-contextual for the particular outcomes. So therefore, if you find that the quantum probabilities are greater than 4, which you do find, I'm not going to go through the details, then you've detected quotient spec and contextuality. Okay, so now I just quickly want to talk about a particular type of non-contextuality inequality, which you can generate with this kind of construction, which is due to Cabello, Severini, and Winter. And they sort of exposed an interesting connection between this and graph theory, which can be useful. So a graph, I mean in the discrete mathematics sense, so you have a bunch of vertices, pairs of vertices can be connected by an edge. So here's an example of a graph, the 5-cycle where I have 5 vertices and these 5 edges like a pentagon. So if we take a graph, then we construct a quantum representation of it in the following way. So every vertex of the graph gets associated to a pure state. And if the vertices are connected by an edge, then I demand that those states are orthogonal. Okay? So this you can think of as the orthogonality graph of some set of quantum states. Okay, so then sort of some graph theory terminology. The independence number of a graph is the size of the largest set of vertices such that no two vertices are connected by an edge. So for this 5-cycle, the independence number is 2. So if I pick this vertex to be in the set, then it can't be either of those two. Then I have to pick either this one or this one, but whichever one I pick, the other one can't be in. Okay, so the independence number is 2 for that case. Okay, so since the non-contextual sets are disjoint for orthogonal states, a chaos non-contextual model, you won't be able to get more than the independence number for this sum of probabilities, okay? Because the condition for independence is basically the same as the condition for not having two orthogonal states assigned the value 1, okay? So we can go to graph theory literature where people have studied a lot of things about independence numbers and generate whole families of non-contextuality inequalities. It's also true, although I won't go into detail, that the maximum possible quantum violation, right? So you, in principle, you can optimize over these states here, so long as they satisfy the orthogonality conditions, and you can optimize over the state that you're preparing. Okay, so you can optimize over those two things. And this optimum turns out to be something that's also studied in the graph theory literature, which was called the Lovats theta function. What's the definition of the Lovats theta function? It's basically just this. It's the same as the quantum value. It turns out that they've been studying it for other reasons, but in particular, it's known to be efficiently computable numerically as well. So, bottom line, finding contextuality inequalities of this type boils down to finding graphs that have a larger Lovats theta number than independence number, and many examples are known. And we will, well, I'm not going to give you any explicit constructions, but I will use this fact later on. Okay, so let me just give you an example, which is this five cycle. This was previously known before the CHCSW work, but here we saw before that we have an independence number of 2. Now, the maximal quantum violation can be found. It turns out to be in a 3D real Hilbert space. It turns out that you can always get the maximum violation in a real Hilbert space. And the states that you have to choose look like this. Okay, so this is in spherical polar coordinates. The parameters are like this. So this is sort of equally spaced states, spaced angles around the equator. But then these are raised up by some angle here, which has cosine 1 over 4th root of 5. I'll give you the geometrical intuition for this in a minute. But if you just take that and compute the quantum probabilities for that, then because this is the input state, the inner product's going to be cos chi. So I'm going to get 5 cos squared chi for all the, when I sum over all of these states. That's going to be root 5. So that's approximately 2.24. And it's larger than this. So that detects Cauchy-Specker contextuality. So let me give you the geometrical intuition. So suppose we're in a real 3D Hilbert space, so I can construct the unit sphere, okay, and then consider the equator of that unit sphere. On the equator of that unit sphere, I'm going to draw a pentagram, a regular pentagram like this. And then you see, and that, so I've labeled, so basically I've just moved around the positions of these vertices so that it becomes a pentagram rather than a pentagon. Right, so this edge now goes from here to here, etc. Now, if you look at the angle, this is the center of the unit sphere. If you look at the angle here, it's larger than 90 degrees. So those are not orthogonal. What I can do is I can take this pentagram on the equator, and I can raise it up the surface of the sphere, keeping it parallel to the equatorial plane. Just raise it up. And then what will happen is that these angles will get smaller as I raise it up. So at some point, they're going to hit 90 degrees. Okay, when they hit 90 degrees, I have the correct orthogonality relations. And then that turns out to be exactly when you have this angle here. So you can work that out. It's the details are a little bit hairy, but that's basically what's going on with these states.
That's a block sphere.
This is not the block sphere. We're in real three-dimensional Hilbert space, right? We're not in complex two-dimensional Hilbert space. So in a real three-dimensional Hilbert space, orthogonality is 90 degrees.
But what's a real three-dimensional Hilbert space?
A real three-dimensional Hilbert space is just, it's spanned by three states, 0, 1, 2, and I restrict attention to real amplitudes, right? So it's just, these are the states where all of these three are real numbers. Okay, so it's a subspace of this.
But the Hilbert space is, per definition, a complex vector space, no?
Not necessarily, it can be over any field. I can define real Hilbert space, complex Hilbert space, quaternionic Hilbert space. It doesn't matter what the field is. But, you know, it doesn't, even if you think that obviously quantum mechanics is described by a complex Hilbert space, I can still construct states that only have real amplitudes. Okay, so it's still a subset of the Q-trit space. Okay. Just so happens that I only need real amplitudes to do this. So what is a real 3D Hilbert space. We're living in it, right? This three-dimensional Euclidean, just the ordinary three-dimensional Euclidean space, Euclidean vector space, right? So when I say orthogonal in that space, I mean really physically orthogonal, 90 degrees. That's what orthogonality corresponds to, right? Okay, now we're going to move on to the topic of psi ontology, or the reality of the wave function. Okay, so the goal of this part is to investigate whether, when I prepare a pure quantum state, it has to be part of the ontology. Okay, so this is in the same sense as it is in, if you remember the Beltrametti-Bugatsky model, the probability distribution corresponding to a particular state preparation is just a delta function on that quantum state. Okay, so that's an example where the state is real, it's part of the ontology. It's also true in the Bell model. In the Bell model, you have this additional variable as well. And similarly, in the Breuer-Bohm theory is like that too, right? It has the wave function plus particle positions. So the real objective of this is to determine, so if you remember the Speck and Spoy theory stuff, we want to determine whether the kind of psi epistemic explanations that we talked about there, the explanations of quantum indistinguishability, of the no-cloning theorem, etc., whether they can really work in actual quantum theory. Okay. So in this section, I'm going to be using this sort of naughty notation, where I'm only preparing pure states, and you can only prove preparation contextuality for mixed states anyhow, but it doesn't really matter, right? So what I'm going to prove would apply for any method of preparing the state psi, and you just get into a notational jumble if you try to, you know, if you try to distinguish p's and psi's. So when I write this, think, there's some particular method of preparing psi, and that's what I mean. Okay, so right. So here are the basic definitions. So if I have two quantum states, I can define their epistemic overlap in an ontological model this way. The diagram is probably more helpful. Here are the two probability measures corresponding to two different states. I just mean the joint area under their graph. That's what that is. So what's going on in this integral is for each value of lambda, I figure out which of these two is smaller. I take that as the value of my function there, and then I integrate that whole thing over all the space. That's just the joint area under these graphs. Okay? Right, so now we have some definitions. So I will say that psi and phi are ontologically distinct if their overlap is zero. Okay? So in graphs, that roughly means this, right? I mean, you can have sort of measure zero overlaps. We don't worry about those. But if this overlap measure is zero, what that really means is that lambda, in some sense, with probability one, allows you to determine which quantum state was prepared. This would be the case of ontologically indistinctness, where you do have overlap, where this would be non-zero. Okay, so then we make the definition, an ontological model is called psiontic if every pair of pure states in the model is ontologically distinct. Okay, so no pair of states overlaps at all. You have completely disjoint probability distributions for each state that you can prepare in the theory. And then we call psi epistemic just the converse of that. So this is a pretty weak definition of psi epistemic. It just means there is some non-zero overlap in the theory somewhere. It's a pretty weak thing, because you could have that there are only two states in the theory which have a very, very tiny amount of overlap. That, according to this definition, would be psi epistemic. We will need to look at stronger notions in a minute. But this is the basic distinction that's used. But is that clear? What's going on here? Okay. Okay, so the first thing to say is this could be the end of the lecture, right? Psi epistemic models exist in all Hilbert space dimensions. Okay. So we've already seen one. One of them is in Hilbert space dimension 2. The Cochen-Speicher model is psi epistemic. Remember the Cochen-Speicher model, when you prepare a state on the Bloch sphere now, back to complex two-dimensional Hilbert space, this is the Bloch vector of that state. Then there's a probability distribution which looks like, goes like cosine squared on this hemisphere. And similarly for this state. So when you have non-orthogonal states, there will be a region of overlap between their probability measures. As we've already seen, qubits are a little bit special. We've already seen at least two things which only kick in when you get to Hilbert space 3, dimension 3 and higher. So one is Cochen-Speicher contextuality. This model, by the way, is Cochen-Speicher non-contextual as well. Cochen-Speicher non-contextuality and Gleason's theorem and things like that only come in at higher dimensions. So you might have thought, okay, this is special. Maybe psi epistemic models don't exist for higher dimensions. But it was proved that they do exist in higher dimensions. Construction is based on a modification of the Bell model. I was going to include it here, but I think there will be a lack of time. So if anybody's interested in how that works, come and ask me later, and I'll explain it to you. Okay, so given that psi epistemic models exist in all finite Hilbert space dimensions, is that the end of the story? No. There are two ways of going here. One is that we can try to prove something that's weaker than full psi ontology that still makes psi epistemic explanations implausible. So we can introduce a stronger notion of what it means to be psi epistemic and try to rule that out. So that's the first thing we'll talk about. And the second thing we can do is we can say, well, you know what? There are some other reasonable constraints that I want my ontological models to satisfy. And that leads to things like the Pusey-Barrett-Rudolph theorem, which we will hopefully also have a little bit of time to talk about. Maybe next time if we don't get to it today. Okay, so now, so maximally psi epistemic models. So what I want you to think about is to consider what was the psi epistemic explanation for the indistinguishability of quantum states. So remember, we talked about this in the setting of the Speckens toy model. So what's that explanation? It says, well, the reason why you can't distinguish these pure states perfectly is because sometimes there's an ontic state that's prepared that's in the support of both of the distributions, right? So if that happens, if I'm in any ontic state in this region, then that could have happened because I prepared psi, or it could have happened because I prepared phi. There's no way that the measurement device could uniquely tell me whether it was psi or phi that was prepared. Okay. So this kind of explanation would be rendered implausible if you find some suitable measure of the overlap of probability distributions and compare it to a measure of the indistinguishability of quantum states. So if you find that the quantum states are almost completely indistinguishable, if they have very large inner product, then your probability of distinguishing them with a quantum measurement is very, very small, probability of successfully doing that. If it turns out that in the ontological model, they have only a very, very tiny, tiny region of overlap, then this explanation isn't really playing a very big role. Right? Most of the time, if you knew the ontic state, you would be able to tell whether it was psi or phi that was prepared. Okay, so in order to implement this, we need two measures of overlap. We need one, a measure of overlap of the probability distributions in the ontological model, and we need a quantum measure of overlap that measures the indistinguishability of the quantum states by quantum measurements. Okay, so we already have our epistemic overlap measure, which was this, basically the area under the joint area under both of the graphs. Now this turns out to have the following operational interpretation, which isn't particularly difficult to prove, but for lack of time, I'm not going to explain exactly where it comes from. So suppose you prepare the system in the state psi or state phi with 50-50 probability, or somebody else does, and you don't know which one's prepared. And then somebody comes along and says, the exact ontic state of the system is lambda. Okay, so normally you don't have access to that information. But if you did know the exact value of lambda, then based on that, your optimal probability for guessing correctly would be this linear function of the overlap. You can see this has the right kind of behavior, right? So if the overlap's zero, then this would be one. If the overlap's one, this would be a half. You'd just be guessing, right? Completely randomly guessing. But that turns out to be the right function. So we need to compare it with the quantum overlap measure, which is this. I mean, this where this comes from is, I'll say something about it in a minute. But the interpretation of this measure is the same kind of thing. So you're either psi or phi is prepared with 50-50 probability, but then instead of learning the exact ontic state, what happens is you're allowed to do a quantum measurement, any quantum measurement you like, could be a POVM, and based on the outcome of that measurement, you're going to guess whether it was psi or phi. Oh, that should be a Q down here. This should be a Q. That's Q. So your probability of correctly guessing based on the outcome of a quantum measurement is this. It's the same function of this of these two overlap measures. So these two overlap measures measure the same sorts of things that we want to compare. So you're measuring things which have comparable operational meaning. Okay, so then we make a definition of maximally psi epistemic if these two measures are the same for all pure states. So it means that the fact that you can't always distinguish psi or phi with a quantum measurement is entirely accounted for by the fact that there's overlap of the probability distributions. You can show the Speckenstoy theory and the Cochin-Specker model are maximally psi epistemic. But we can rule this out in higher dimensions. Let me just make a couple of comments here. There's more than one definition of maximally psi epistemic in the literature, right? Because in principle, you know, there's more than one way of measuring the indistinguishability of things, right? Here I've chosen this particular operational interpretation, which is called minimum error state discrimination, right? That's its technical name. But there's other things. We could measure, for example, clonability, right? What's the, how well can you make a clone of this state approximately, right? That's another kind of measure of the indistinguishability of quantum states. There are other types of state discrimination. The basic principle is the same. You'd want to set the overlap measures the same, but just to let you know that those things sometimes classify models differently. There are certain measures under which at least the Speckenstoy theory isn't maximally psi epistemic. So although you expect all of these measures to give you sort of qualitatively similar kinds of results, there's still sort of no reason of principle for choosing one particular measure rather than the other. This one is just happens to be easy to work with. Okay, so one reason why I'm telling you this is that in the literature, there are two definitions which are prominent. One of them is very, very closely connected to Cochin-Specker contextuality. And if you remember that hierarchy of no-go theorems, where I had Cochin-Specker contextuality implies non-maximally psi epistemic implies preparation contextual, you need to use that definition, not this one. This one's still connected to contextuality, but not so closely. And the reason why I'm using this one is because, reason why this one sort of has won in the literature is because this is robust to small experimental imperfections. So if you demand that your ontological model only has to approximately reproduce the predictions of quantum theory, then this kind of definition still gives you something that's robust to that, whereas the other definitions, some of the other definitions don't. Okay, but that's just all an aside, really. So how do we rule this out? Okay, we can rule this out using non-contextuality inequalities. The first thing to note is if we look at the definition of this overlap, then it's less than this, okay? So what I can do is note, so here this is the support of the epistemic state for phi, so the set of values for which this is non-zero, you can note that I could restrict this integral to this set, because anywhere where this guy is zero, it's obviously going to be the minimum, right? So it'll just be zero for those values. Okay, so I can restrict this integral to this support, and then when I do that, I note that the minimum of these two things is less than just one of them, okay? So I have this inequality. This is the probability that, this epistemic state assigns to the support of the epistemic state for phi. Now, we already showed in the lemma, remember the lemma that we used in Hardy's excess baggage theorem, that the support of a probability distribution is contained in this. So this is the set of states which always yield, which always give you the outcome phi for the particular basis measurement m. We showed that last time. So, however, this is true for any basis measurement that includes phi. So I have this inclusion for every possible basis that includes phi. So it's a subset of all of those things. So therefore, it's also a subset of the of their intersection. And that means that the support of this probability distribution is contained inside the non-contextual set for phi. So this is less than or equal to this, because if I integrate over a larger set, a probability distribution over a larger set, I can only get a larger value. Right? So this is the probability assigned to the non-contextual set by psi. It's larger than, always larger than, this epistemic overlap. Okay, so that means that if we now consider a set of states and take a sum of these guys, this is less than the sum of the probabilities assigned to the non-contextual sets. But this is precisely the thing that was bounded by a non-contextuality inequality. Okay, so what you can do is take a non-contextuality inequality, it gives you an upper bound on this, that will also give you an upper bound on the epistemic overlaps in the ontological model. And then what we can do is we can take the quantum states, we can take the quantum states that are optimal for the contextuality proof, and we can simply compute what their quantum overlap is. Now remember, the quantum overlap was this funny function. It was this funny function. So it's not exactly the same as the quantum value for the contextuality inequality, because in that case, on the right-hand side, you would just take this. But in any case, the two functions are going to be sort of qualitatively very similar. So a set of states that's optimal for this will be close to optimal for that anyway. This one's a little bit harder to optimize. Okay, so then if you find that the sum of the quantum values is strictly larger than the sum of these non-contextual values, then that means that this is strictly less than that. So that rules out the maximally psi epistemic models. Okay, so what I actually like to do is to compare the averages of these things, right? So we can look at the average epistemic overlap of this set of states and the average of the quantum overlap. The reason for doing that is we want to compare the performance of proofs, contextuality inequalities, which have different numbers of states in them. So I want to say, you know, on average, how much difference between quantum and epistemic overlap is there? So clearly, if this is very large, imagine if this quantum overlap is close to 1 and that this classical overlap is close to 0. If that's true, then almost all the states in the set, they you know, almost completely overlap. I mean, they're almost completely indistinguishable by quantum measurements, but their overlap would be very tiny, right? So that would put the maximally, that would put the psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability in trouble. Okay, so what I'm going to do is show you some of the results here, right? So basically, all of these papers they make a contextuality inequality construction. This one, the one that I did, and this one here, are based on that CSW graph theory construction that I told you about. So you just find a graph which has a very large Lovatz theta number and a pretty small independence number, okay? And then you do the mathematics. These guys are based on a different kind of contextuality proof, but it's still a contextuality proof. So these are constructions. These are the Hilbert space dimensions they exist in. Here are the number of states involved in the proof. For these two, the number of states, so for these two, the number of states involved is just a function of the Hilbert space dimension. For these two, they're an independent parameter. And I have to say that this proof here is highly non-constructive. It just shows that there exists a graph with certain properties. There's a certain family of graphs. We don't know exactly how many of them there are, but we know that there's a series of increasing NJs, numbers of vertices, that forms an infinite sequence. And then these epsilon and delta are just small parameters that you can make as small as you like in the usual of analytic way. So here are the classical overlaps you get, and here are the quantum overlaps you get. So this table by itself isn't particularly instructive. So what I did was, you know, if you optimize the difference between LQ and LE, right, you want to get that, in order to make psi epistemic explanations implausible, you want to make that difference as large as possible. Okay, so I'm going to take that difference and then just find the optimal dimension, find the optimal parameters that you get. And this is what happens with those proofs. So you can see that state of the art is that that we know if we take the limit of this proof that we can get the difference between average of the quantum and the classical or epistemic overlap about 0.3. Okay? So all of these things rule out maximally psi epistemic models because this would have to be zero, right, in a maximally psi epistemic model. But as you can see, the best proof that we have is this horribly non-constructive thing, and it has a very large number of states and Hilbert space dimension. Okay, so what's the conclusion of that? Well, in any ontological model, right, we have two ways of explaining the indistinguishability of quantum states, okay? The first is what I've been talking about. States may be indistinguishable because the corresponding probability distributions overlap. But of course, psiontic models exist as well, like the Bell model, Beltrametti, Bugatsky, and so forth. And in those models, you can't make use of such an explanation. There is no overlap. There must be another way that it can happen. And the other way that it can happen is, of course, that the quantum measurements don't tell you lambda exactly. They only give you some coarse-grained information about lambda. Okay. Right, so you have these two ways of explaining indistinguishability. So if you like psi epistemic theories, then it's sort of clear that this explanation has to play some sort of role. Otherwise, you're not going to get all of the nice goodies that we have in Speckens toy theory, where you explain a lot of things in terms of overlap of the epistemic states. But it's not entirely clear that this should play absolutely no role, right? Why not have part of the indistinguishability explained by coarse graining? Okay, so therefore it's not clear that just proving that you're not maximally psi epistemic is really good enough to rule out these theories. What you want is to get this quantity, the difference, as close to one as possible. Because if it's close to one, then you know that you have states which are almost the same quantum mechanically, so very, very indistinguishable, yet have a very tiny overlap in the ontological model. And then when that happens, it's clear that the psi epistemic explanations of everything, which are based on overlap, are just going to completely fail. Okay, so the research project is to get that as close to one as possible. All right. I'm at least going to start this bit, but we'll probably have to finish it next time. Okay, so remember I told you there's another strategy. The other strategy is to say, let's make some additional assumption. So we know that psi epistemic models exist, but maybe, you know, there are other reasonable properties that we want our realist models to satisfy, and if we add those, we may be able to prove that the wave function really has to be real. And this is what's done by the PBR theorem. There are a few other similar results in the literature, but in my opinion, this is still the most compelling one. Okay, so we need an additional assumption. The additional assumption they used is called the preparation independence postulate. Preparation independence postulate can be broken down into two assumptions that I will now explain. Okay. First is this Cartesian product assumption. So suppose you have two systems and I prepare them in a product state. They're two, let's say they're two qubits, two systems of the same Hilbert space dimension. I'm going to prepare them in a product state. Then, you know, each system individually can have an ontological model. It would have its own ontic state space, its own epistemic states, and so forth. When I bring these things together and treat them as a joint system, I'm going to say that the joint ontic state space, when I prepare a product state, can be thought of as just a Cartesian product of the two individual state spaces. So what that means is that the ontic state of the joint system is just specify an ontic state for system A and specify an ontic state for system B separately. Okay? And then, once I have that, there's this no correlation assumption which says that the joint state, when I prepare this product state, over these two ontic states should just be the product of the individual distributions. Right? So if I was dealing with system A alone and just doing experiments on that, then I would have some epistemic state for preparing psi A. If I was just dealing with system B on its own, I'd have this. And when I just bring them together and treat them as a joint system, this just says that I should have the product of those two distributions. Okay, so here's a very important subtlety. If you think about joint systems in general, if I have a joint system which has two subsystems, then in principle you might have some global property of the joint system that doesn't reduce to properties of the individual systems. This will, in particular, happen in a psi-ontic model. In a psi-ontic model, if the wave function, if the quantum state is part of the state of reality, and I prepare the system in an entangled state, then the system has a property that is not a property of the two subsystems. That's the entangled quantum state. So if we're trying to prove that models must be psi-ontic, you don't want to rule out the possibility that there are such properties a priori. That would be bad, because their scientific models wouldn't satisfy that assumption. Okay, so in general, you need that there can also be global properties that are not reducible to properties of the two subsystems. So all we're really requiring from this Cartesian product assumption is that these global properties play no role when you prepare the system in a product state. So we only need to apply this when we're preparing the system in a product state. So you can imagine that when you prepare the system in a product state, there's just one particular global state that's a flag that says the system's in a product state, so ignore me, right? That plays no role in determining measurement outcomes for a product state. And then you should read the no correlation assumption as saying this applies to the marginal on the local properties. So what we're saying is, yes, there can be global properties, but when you prepare the system in a pure state, they're relevant. Only local properties of the individual subsystems are relevant. Okay. So that's the assumption, and it really needs to be phrased in this more general way, because otherwise psi-ontic models would violate it for entangled states. How much time have we got left? Probably not enough time to get through this.
How much longer would it take?
Maybe 10 minutes, but...
It would be good since we're doing it on the tutorial.
Are you doing it on the tutorial today? So if people don't mind me get running over a bit, then... Okay. Okay, so the PBR theorem then says that any ontological model of the quantum theory which satisfies this must be psi-ontic. So I'm not going to prove that general result. I'm just going to prove that these two non-orthogonal states have to be ontologically distinct. They have to have no overlap.
The general strategy, if you want to look up the general proof, don't read the PBR theorem paper. Read this one, because this is a much simpler proof. And it's based on quite a straightforward generalization of this idea to multiple systems. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is generalize the two-way overlap to the n-way overlap. Right? So instead of taking the minimum of just two probabilities, I'm going to take the minimum of the whole set. Okay, so this will be zero if there's no point at which all of the probability distributions are not zero. So this is just a generalization of the two-way overlap that we had before. Okay, so then the engine of the proof is this concept that I call anti-distinguishability. So let's understand that. So suppose you have a set of n quantum states. They're called anti-distinguishable. That should have been subscript J there. Suppose there exists an n outcome measurement, it could be a POVM, such that I never get outcome J when I prepare state psi J. So for every state in the set, one of the outcomes never occurs. It's a different one for each one. Let's see. This kind of simple example of an anti-distinguishable set for a qubit. If I take three states like this, then I can construct a POVM where this POVM element is orthogonal to this guy, this POVM element is orthogonal to this guy, and this POVM element is orthogonal to that guy. And then I just have to renormalize these so that the sum is a valid POVM. Okay, so you can see that if I prepare this state, I'll never get this outcome. A projector onto an orthogonal, and if I play this one, I'll never get that outcome. So that's just a simple example of doing it with a qubit for a POVM. And you can see that this is weaker than the requirement that the states be distinguishable, right? They have to be orthogonal if they're distinguishable. Okay, so then you can prove that if a set of states is anti-distinguishable, then in any ontological model, the n-way overlap has to be zero. So proving this fully rigorously, you need to take care of measure theoretic complications. But what I'm going to do is give you the outcome, the basic idea. So let's imagine, for sake of simplicity, that lambda is a finite space. If there are only a finite number of lambdas, then in order for this to be non-zero, there would have to be a lambda that's assigned non-zero probability by all of these states. Okay, so assume such a lambda exists. Then, in order to reproduce this, you would require that, because that lambda can occur, regardless of which of these quantum states you prepare, because that lambda can occur, you would require to reproduce this, that the probability of all the outcomes would be zero for that lambda. But this is supposed to be a probability distribution over outcomes, so it must sum to 1. Okay, so therefore, if you have anti-distinguishability, no such lambda can exist. And on a continuous space, you have to generalize that idea slightly and use a bit of mesh theory, but it's the same idea. Okay, so now, remember we were interested in the state 0 and plus. So let's construct these four states, which are just all possible tensor products of those. Then we can show that this set of four states is anti-distinguishable. So if we construct these four states, where the minus state is defined analogously to the plus state as 0 minus 1, then you can check that these four states are orthogonal, so they form an orthonormal basis, and they anti-distinguish these states. Okay, so if I do a measurement in this orthonormal basis, I prepare that state, I'll never get that outcome, prepare that state, I'll never get that outcome, etc. Okay, so what that means is that is that by our lemma, the four-way overlap is zero. And but now we can introduce the PIP. Because these are product states, psi 1 is a product state of 0 is 0, then The probability when I prepared slide one is just a product of the zero probability distribution with the zero probability distribution, and so forth, all of them. Okay, so then I compute this multi-way overlap with these product distributions. And then what you see is that I have every combination of the zero probability distribution and the plus probability distribution. Okay, so in the first slot, I can have zero or plus, and in the second slot, I can have zero or plus, I can have any combination that I like. So the way to minimize that for a particular lambda is to just minimize the first component and minimize the second component separately, right? Because then that will pick out which of these product distributions is the minimum. So because I've got every possible combination here, I can factorize this into two separate overlaps, one on space A and one on space B. But these are just the same overlap by the preparation independence postulate. These are the same probability distributions. So it's just the square of the overlap between 0 and plus. Now, because we know that this is 0, it's square. I mean, we know that the square of this is 0, so that's the same thing. So overlap between 0 and plus is 0. And so therefore, they're ontologically distinct. OK, so that's pretty much the end of the proof. And in order to show that you have a fully psiontic model, you have to do a similar thing for every pair of every possible pair of quantum states. But the basic idea of how to do it is this. So there's just one more slide here. So let me just outline what the conclusion of this is. So PBR theorem, I would say, renders scientific explanations rather implausible in the ontological models framework. I think the preparation independence postulate is quite plausible. It certainly holds in things like Bohmian mechanics and so forth. So people do question that postulate. They're saying, well, let's have a more general kind of theory. Labour's really come up with something that looks sort of compelling that does that. The upshot of the overlap bound stuff, the non-maximally psi epistemic, is a bit more ambiguous because we only have this sort of 0.3 value at the moment. So anyway, apart from the fundamental interest, remember I showed you, I put up a slide a couple of lectures ago showing that psi ontology is quite near the top of the hierarchy of no-go theorems. Right? You could, apart from Cauchy's speck of contextuality, you could derive almost everything else from it. So from that point of view, the PBR theorem isn't quite ideal because we need to add an extra assumption, whereas all the other things in that hierarchy could be proved without additional assumptions. So you would like proof of something like psi ontology that doesn't involve additional assumptions. Here are some things that are still possibly true. First of all, we may be able to obtain better overlap bounds. Maybe that I can get that arbitrarily close to one. We don't know. Beginning of that kind of research. It could be that psi epistemic models are impossible for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. We know that they exist in all finite Hilbert space dimensions, but it is nonetheless true that the amount of overlap decreases, right, as you go up in Hilbert space dimensions. So it could be that there's no psi epistemic model of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space without any additional assumptions. And all of the proofs so far have only objective measurements. All of this would involve projective measurements. It could be the case that if you start trying to reproduce the statistics of PODNs, that you rule out psi epistemic models, even for a qubit, we don't know. One thing we do know is that the Cauchy-Speckle model, which is kind of, in some sense, the nicest ontic model we know of, because it's maximally psi epistemic, non-contextualized, all these properties, we know that that can't be extended to PODNs. Right? If I try to use the same epistemic distributions for pure states and say, okay, let me try and reproduce statistics for a PODN, you can show that you can't do that. And so there's evidence that you would get more out of this if you started considering PODNs, just that we don't at the moment know any great proof techniques for bounding overlaps in terms of PODNs. So thank you for bearing with me for the extra few minutes. Yeah, that's it for today. Thanks.